In a true mentoring situation where they're both active educators, the mentor is looking at also gaining new ideas because the new teacher is coming in with some innovative things that maybe they've recently developed. And as an experienced educator, sometimes get caught in a rut and they're not looking to maybe change that rut a little bit, and yet they see something that is working with students, you know, and then they'll have that conversation. So yes, it is a two-way. It's a two-way relationship, and I think a seasoned educator can learn from the newer educator.
Hello and welcome to School Me, a podcast from the National Education Association. On this show, we talk to seasoned educators and experts to give new educators the tools they need to thrive in their careers. I'm your host, Natika Samuels. With each passing generation, educators learn something new. We build on what we've inherited from our predecessors, and we can in turn share what we've learned with them. This is the advantage of working in schools where multiple generations are represented, and today we're talking about intergenerational relationships in the school and about mentoring and how members of every generation of educators can learn from one another. For this conversation, we tapped Lindy Hyatt-Hecox, a retired educator with 33 years of classroom experience and an active mentor in her state of Illinois. Welcome, Lindy.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about you. What made you decide to become a teacher?
My grandmother was a Chicago Public Schools teacher for 40 years, and I would spend time at the classroom. I'd visit her school and hang out with the kids and so forth. She taught special education, and I also knew that I could play school with my friends and be the one who was the boss and tell them what to do and everything, so that fit right into my personality. Also in the 70s, the opportunities for young girls going away to college seemed to be limited to three basic areas: become a teacher, become a nurse, or go into business, but it was secretarial. If you want a business, then that's where you were going to end up as a secretary. And I knew I didn't want that, and I hated the sight of blood, so that left teaching. So that's how I ended up, and made the right choice, I believe.
So you have 3 decades plus of classroom experience. Take me through the journey of your educational life.
I majored in special education at Illinois State University and was hired in 1977 in Joliet, Illinois, and I taught special ed hearing impaired students for 4 years. Then I was home with my own kids for 4 years, although I was working things like part-time daycare centers and stuff just to make some extra cash while I was home on leave. And then I started teaching in 1985 in Wheaton, Illinois, in a Title I program. I had also then started working on a master's degree in learning disabilities and so forth, and my master's was through Northern Illinois University, but I was able to apply what I was learning in the master's to what I was teaching. My entire career was mainly specialist, so reading specialist, Title I math and reading. Prior to that was the special education. I actually team taught in classrooms, regular elementary level classrooms, but I never actually was a classroom elementary teacher. I did spend 6 years teaching at the other end of the spectrum, gifted children, which are very similar in many ways to the special ed population. They had their own unique needs.
So you're taking on mentorship even now as a retired member?
Just starting a new program, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that program?
It's an NEA initiative called Safe Spot, and I only heard about it myself a few months back, where we pair retired teachers with early educators, less than 5 years experience. We're now in the development stages of this program. We're going to pilot it. We're going to see how it goes.
What is the goal of Safe Spot, and how are you looking to make a difference with the program?
I think we have a student mentoring program with the IEA retired is involved, and we've had that for several years. And those are the aspiring educators you mentioned, but they're college students in teacher education programs. One of the thoughts that I've always wondered about, well, what happens when they get into the real classrooms, they graduate, they start their actual teaching profession, where it seemed like we're just dropping the ball right there and we're leaving it up to the school district to do their own thing. And many school districts don't have that ability. So the idea is to help them, and also to help NEA be relevant to these new teachers so that they see a reason for his NEA is not just about contract negotiations. We're about professional development and making sure they succeed. So pairing up retired educators who have more time, who maybe recently been retired, to have one-on-one conversations, that's the key, needs to be one-on-one. Safe Spot, the title of that is based on a safe spot to go, away from the school building where there's no administrator wondering what's going on, who is this person here. It also helps the retiree. They don't want the hassle of trying to get into a secure building. All of our buildings are very secure now, and they don't want to have to hassle with that. So go to Starbucks, go to Panera, have a meal, and meet and talk and try to get to the bottom of, like, how are things going? And just very informal. And the conversations will develop as the relationship builds.
So do you see that there's a difference between the way that a retired teacher might mentor a new educator versus the way that someone who's in the same school but farther along in their career might mentor them? Are there different values and benefits to the retired versus just the seasoned?
And we've explored that to see how will this be different. The local Teachers Association, the local that we're involved with, that we're in a pilot with, they have a pretty strong mentoring program in place that they've negotiated, and it's being supported by the district. So their first question was, well, why do we need this, you know, as we talk to them? And my focus with that pilot group will be, you have a mentoring program for the first 2 years, but then what? And oftentimes teachers will change grade levels within that 5-year period. So they might be comfortable with the one, but after 2 years, you know, year 3, 4, 5, there are other crises that could occur, and there needs to be a better conversation again. There are also, in Illinois, the 10-year law kicks in at, you know, after 4 years of probationary teaching, and oftentimes we will see, all right, the district's going to hold out, but year 4, if you're just not cutting it, you're out. And oftentimes in year 3 and 4, there could be issues that haven't been ironed out that only a 2-year mentoring program would have offered. So it's a sort of a complement to the mentoring program that already exists.
And it's helpful to have someone who's seen the full, like, life cycle of the career and give that perspective versus someone who's in it right now and navigating their own way. So what are the main concerns that you're hearing from the newer educators that you are contacting and mentoring?
Keep in mind, this program is just in its development stages, but we anticipate that the biggest concerns will be how to deal with the parents, how to deal with classroom management. And these are ongoing issues even a veteran teacher is going to have issues with. Those conversations to ask what works, what doesn't work, try this, try that. And sometimes administrators aren't as supportive as they could be, or there's an intimidation factor that needs to be dealt with, or how do you approach the administrator? Sometimes an early educator might have a fear in approaching their superior with a concern or question because they fear something's going to come back to haunt them at some point, or it's going to show up on an evaluation or something like that. So oftentimes they'll feel more comfortable running it past their mentor, or in this case, a retiree who has absolutely nothing to lose and can be very frank and open about, well, here's what you should try to do, and so forth. So there's a level of comfort, I think, that occurs more so because it's somebody outside the system.
We're talking a lot about mentorship here, but it's a relationship between two people.
Yes.
There's the younger person, the older person,
right.
And that doesn't always mean that the older person is the only person imparting knowledge or helping. So do you see the relationship going both ways, sort of a symbiotic relationship, when we have an intergenerational relationship in the school where the younger teacher is helping the more seasoned teacher become even better at their craft?
In a true mentoring situation where they're both active educators, the mentor is also gaining new ideas because the new teacher is coming in with some innovative things that maybe they've recently developed. And as an experienced educator, sometimes get caught in a rut and they're not looking to maybe change that rut a little bit. And yet they see something that is working with students, you know, and then they'll have that conversation. So yes, it is a two-way relationship. And I think a seasoned educator can learn from the newer educator. Burnout is a huge problem with veteran educators, and it is time to be open to see what happens and what they can learn and glean from it as well.
So it's an opportunity to sort of reinvigorate your passion for the job and your ways of doing things. Do you have any idea what the typical lesson that the veteran teachers are learning from the younger teachers?
The one problem that the veteran educators might encounter is the newer teachers are talking about a particular way to teach reading. I'll use reading as an example, and I'm looking at elementary students. So there'll be an approach, a reading strategy, a reading, you know, and sometimes the veteran educators say, tried that, didn't work. You know, we did that back in the 80s and, you know, called it something a little different, but it was basically the same thing. And a lot of times those things do come back, but they come back slightly different. So you have to be open to that. Well, all right, hopefully educators learned why it didn't work in the 80s, and now it's coming back repackaged as something else, and how can we improve it? And so there is a lot of collaboration there to see, and I think that's the beauty of teaching and educating and helping each other is the collaboration.
We've talked about a lot of the good things about intergenerational relationships in the school and the symbiotic relationship that a newer and more experienced educator can have, but what are some of maybe the pitfalls or obstacles or hurdles that people need to jump over that might present themselves so that people can be aware of what to watch out for with that relationship?
The thing that keeps coming back to mind for me is to understand the history of the profession. They don't have that. They're coming in expecting things. And the veteran teachers have what they have today because of the fights that were fought in the past. And the early educators don't get that. They think the job conditions were always this good. Now, in an area where the conditions are really poor right now, that conversation doesn't exist because everybody's still fighting. Or they had benefits and then they were taken away, or whatever the case may be. But in the more affluent areas where the labor movement is more accepted amongst the profession, amongst teachers, so in states that are strong, working conditions are good, and the pay is decent, those were fights that were fought by these veteran teachers years ago. And there's always a sense of, I don't want to call it anger, but on the part of the veteran educator, you know, you just don't understand that we fought for this benefit. And now with the Janus decision and so forth, they don't understand. So what's the big deal? Why do I have to join the union? Now they have that choice. They don't have to join. And so to try to convince them, this is important and this is your profession. I know that may be not a path you were thinking of exploring, but that's a huge piece of this.
The strength of the union depends on the buy-in for the value of it.
Right.
And I can understand that there's a fear that if the younger generations don't see that value, that we'll all see a depletion of the power of associations and the collective power that you have. Thanks for listening to School Me, and a quick thank you to all of the NEA members listening. If you have a question for one of our experts or just need some support as you're getting your career started, please leave us a message on our line at 240-780-8329. That's 240-780-8329. And your voicemail might be played on air. You can also email your question to us at schoolmeplease@nea.org. That's schoolmeplease, all one word, at nea.org. So what excites you about the future of education and the educators you're meeting?
The motivation. If they're choosing education as a profession right now in the current climate, they must really be motivated. I hope that's why they're choosing it. I hope they're not choosing it because they can't get a job in anything else. That would be sad. And it pains me if some people are viewing the profession, I can't make enough money, I'm not even going to go into teaching. And given the political climate that teachers are facing across the country, it's not an attractive profession right now. It really isn't. So if, in spite of all of those negatives, if they're choosing and they really still want to be a teacher, that's hope for our society. Then they must really, I'm hoping, they really want to do this because they really want to do this. I think the concern that career changers nowadays, I mean, it is well known that we're not keeping the veteran teachers. They're leaving the profession for various reasons, a lot of them financial, or the pressure, just the political pressure that's happening, and moving on and saying, I don't need this anymore. I can make more money in another field, less headaches. That's truly sad if that's what happens. But so the 33-year veterans, I'm wondering how many in 33 years from now are we going to see how many 33-year veterans there actually are.
What's something that a young educator has taught you?
The technology piece that sometimes school districts held off on putting money into that because there was more important things to spend their money on, like books. But then you have a referendum pass or something, and then there's all of a sudden there's some money. So they go out and they buy some computers. And I came of an age where there was no technology. By the time I retired, it was so beyond me And I was teaching in a special program that physically my room that I saw groups of three or four children at a time, we just didn't simply have the room in the classroom to give them a bank of computers and or a smart board on the wall or something like that. So I was still using a whiteboard with markers, which was a graduation point because when I started teaching it was a chalkboard. So things have evolved. I never got past a certain point. Technology-wise, if I were substitute teaching right now, I would have trouble learning how to use all the technology pieces that I have or that are available to a teacher. But I think in how to have the technology that was available to me, how to use that, I had to learn from my younger colleagues, more experienced in the technology field than I was. And that was a piece that I still would not be comfortable with. I would feel that I would need help. Somebody would have to mentor me.
Yeah, that's all valuable. Like times change so fast that you can't expect people to keep up, and that's what the collaboration is for. I'm glad that you got a chance to do that.
The other thing is arranging the room, the classroom, and having centers, having the kids be able to move around, and creative seating arrangements, and many classrooms are moving into the arena of not even having regular chairs. They'll have the stand-up desks and they'll have the little ball things that the kids can sit on now. It depends, again, on the money, if the school is willing to invest in that. There are grants that some districts offer to teachers and they'll come and outfit a particular classroom through a foundation grant or something like that. And I do stay active in my school district, my old school district, but as part of a committee that does approve those grant applications for those kinds of things. So that's been creative for me to keep a foot in there to see just what's going on right now. And I'm amazed.
If someone comes to you and says, I'm thinking about becoming a teacher, I'm thinking about going into this profession, why would you encourage them to do it? We've talked a little bit about the pitfalls and the obstacles and the hardships, but why would you tell them, yeah, you should explore this and you should go for it?
I would ask them why they want to become a teacher. I think I would want to hear them verbalize that. I would ask them, what makes you think you'd like to? And I'm not trying to dissuade them, but they better have the right motive, and it better be about the students, and it better be about society and believing in the concept of public education. And if it's something else about, well, I want my job, I want a job with the summers off, you know, then that's the wrong reason to be going in. So I think it's going to depend on how their answer to that question.
So what are the right reasons in your opinion?
To want to watch a child grow, to have a love of children. And if it's not little kids, then have a love of the adolescents. But seeing young adults, making young adults that are going to be successful in their adult life, just promoting society in general, because an educated society is what we have to have. So if they have to have that core belief, that has to be a value. And if that isn't in their value system, then they should not enter education. But they should understand that it's not an easy profession and it may not pay the best. So the reality check has to be there too. So it's hard work.
What is some of the best advice that you've ever been given about your career?
Become friends with the building secretary.
Why is that? How's it helped you?
That's who really runs the school, is the secretary. The principal's there, but the secretary knows everything that's going on. And if you need a favor, you better be on her good side, or he.
Is that a common piece of advice that you give to your mentees?
Yeah.
Is that like the first?
Definitely. Take time for yourself. New early educators work long hours, stay after. And that's a problem with elementary as well. It's just there's so not too much you can take home with you, but they're still going to take things home anyway. Working long hours, getting ready. So there has to be some time management stuff in there too, organizational stuff. It's horrible if you're not an organized person and your desk is a mess and you can't find what you need. I mean, some people function nicely that way and most of us cannot. And I guess the behavior, the management of a classroom, how to get on top of so many different needs of so many kids. And often it could be behavior needs, it could be social needs. And nowadays it's often special ed needs and students learning English. And I mean, they're all lumped into one big classroom. And how do you sort all that out? That's tough.
Yeah, that does sound like a hard thing to wrap your head around, but it it's part of the job, right?
Right.
Maybe someone's struggling with that. So if you have an early career educator, for example, they might be in their third year because they're approaching the tenure spot in their state. And they have to make this decision, am I in or am I out? And they are feeling really overwhelmed and thinking of leaving the profession before they can even get that opportunity. What would be your advice for them, or what do you think that they should think about and consider and do to decide what's right for them?
Well, I think it's going to depend on what their concern is. So the one-on-one conversation with that is to take you through a day from the time they get to school, from the time they get up. What are they doing before they come to school? How early are they getting to school? How are they approaching that particular day? And you can't just take it one day at a time. So how are they approaching the whole week? Hopefully they've got a long-range plan for the month, and then they've got a week-by-week plan in their head. Then it now is written down. You're in that week. Can you stick to that plan? And I think where people become overwhelmed is they aren't able to stick to their plan, or maybe they've just tried to plan. People tend to plan too much, and they need to break it down into smaller chunks. Taking the day-to-day on that has to be part of the conversation if they're feeling extremely overwhelmed. You have to find out what is overwhelming them. It could be the parents. It could be the technology piece. It could be just the record keeping. It could be they have three kids in their room that are just running the show, or just so distracting that the rest of the kids aren't making it. I don't know. It just depends on that situation. Each issue has to be tackled one at a time. And then you'd have to decide what's the priority. What's the one we have to fix first? So yeah, you're going to try to save them. But if their mind's already made up, then they need to go. We're not going to save every early educator.
And not everybody's cut out for education. If everybody could do it, you know, we wouldn't have a shortage of teachers.
Right.
So that makes sense that people just need to figure out if it's right for them and if there are practical solutions to their issues. So what is some advice that you would give to your younger and less experienced educator self? If you could take a piece of knowledge from now to then and transport it into your brain and help yourself out, what would you do?
Don't worry about the minutiae. Focus and keep focused on where the kids are going to be at the end of the year. Look at the big picture. And once you can figure out that big picture, keep that in your focus and then break it down. If you don't keep that in your focus and you're just working from one week to the next with no sense of the big picture, you lose sight and you get hung up in that week-to-week stuff. Then all of a sudden, the school year's approaching the end and you realize in panic mode, you didn't even make half the progress you'd hoped you'd made. And maybe the goal is to also not try to take on as much as you thought, not try to solve the world problems in your 1 year in the classroom. So I think they come out of college and they're all pie in the sky. I'm gonna save the world. Well, you know, you're not gonna save the world. And not every student in your classroom is going to succeed the way you hope. And that's a reality check for new teachers. It's hard.
Do you have like a top three pieces of advice that you find yourself giving over and over again?
Just what I said, that's pretty much the biggie. The other one is keep your desk clean. Or at least organized. Or if you're a pile person like I am, make sure your piles are organized. But don't turn it into a big mountain mess.
Great. Well, Lindy, thank you for coming and talking to me today about this really interesting and important topic.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to School Me, and a quick thank you to all of the NEA members listening. If you have a question for one of our experts or just need some support as you're getting your career started, please leave us a message on our line at 240-780-8329. That's 240-780-8329. And your voicemail might be played on air. You can also email your question to us at schoolmeplease@nea.org. That's schoolmeplease, all one word, @nea.org.